International.
Climate change. The poisonous politics of water. Polarization makes it harder to adapt to increasing droughts and floods.
The water thieves come at night. They arrive in trucks, suck water out of irrigation canals and drive off. This infuriates Alejandro Meneses, who owns a big vegetable farm in Coquimbo, a parched province of Chile. In theory, his landholding comes with the right to pour 40 litres of river water a second on his fields. But thanks to drought, exacerbated by theft, he can get just a tenth of that, which he must negotiate with his neighbours. If the price of food goes up, because farmers like him cannot grow enough, there will be a big social problem, he says. The world's water troubles can be summed up in six words: too little, too much, too dirty, says Charlie Iceland of the World Resources Institute, or WRI, a think tank. Climate change will only aggravate the problem. Already, roughly half of humanity lives under what the WRI calls highly water-stressed conditions for at least 1 month a year. Adapting will require not only new technology, but also new politics. Villages, regions, and countries will need to collaborate to share scarce water and build flood defences. The needs of farmers, who use 70% of the world's fresh water, must be balanced with those of the urbanites they feed, as well as industry. In short, a politics of trust, give and take, and long-term planning is needed. Yet the spread of them and us demagoguery makes this harder. A global study by Jens Marquardt and Markus Lederer of the University of Darmstadt notes that populists stir up anger, sow distrust of science, and dismiss climate policies as the agenda of liberal elites. Around 97% of the water on Earth sits in the salty ocean. Land, lake, and river-bound life depends on the remaining 3%. Although the amount of water on Earth is immutable, the daedal workings that move it around are not. The water cycle is made up of a dizzying number of processes, many of them non-linear, which operate across manifold timescales and areas. All are ultimately driven by the energy of the sun, which makes seawater evaporate, plants transpire, and by disproportionately heating the tropics, powers ocean currents and weather systems. Global warming alters the ways water behaves. It intensifies the water cycle, increasing the severity of both very wet events and very dry ones. Warmer air can hold more moisture, which also evaporates more readily out of warmer oceans. More moisture in the atmosphere means more water falls back as rain or snow. This increases the likelihood of heavier deluges in wet regions and of less potential precipitation in drier spots. Thirsty air there is more likely to suck moisture out of the soil, prolonging and worsening droughts. The UN reckons that flooding affected around 1.6 billion people between 2002 and 2021, killing nearly 100,000 and causing economic losses of over $830 billion. Droughts in the same period affected 1.4 billion, killed over 20,000 and cost $170 billion. The World Bank estimates that by 2099, the global supply of fresh water per head will fall by 29% from what it was in 2000 and by a massive 67% in Africa, while rising by 28% in Europe. In Chile, too little is becoming a crisis for which politics is nowhere close to finding a solution. It is the most water-stressed country in South America. Santiago, the sprawling capital, is all right now, but in 10 years' time it might not be, warns Jessica Lopez, the Minister for Public Works. For centuries, Chileans who wanted water simply took it from streams and rivers or sank wells to pump groundwater. But as parts of the country dry up, Water rules written in wetter times are increasingly out of date. Intense distrust between left and right in a country that has seen massive protests in recent years makes them hard to revise. Conservative governments granted many landowners water rights, allowing them to pump a generous amount each day free of charge and forever. Today, the total volume of granted water rights far exceeds what can sustainably be extracted. So farmers like Mr. Meneses have had to sit down with their local water association and agree on how much everyone can pump. Yet some people cheat, sinking illicit boreholes. Tension between big farmers, small farmers, and villagers is high. We're surrounded by farms with illegal wells, and that is why we have no water, says Erica Diaz, a hard-up villager who relies on water trucks and recycles her washing-up water onto her vegetable patch. Conservative Chilean landowners think of water rights as a natural part of property rights. But water is not like land. A house need not encroach upon a neighbour, but a well depletes groundwater for everyone. Granting a fixed volume of water rights in perpetuity is nuts. Meanwhile, politicians and activists on the Chilean left push the notion that water is a human right. A draft constitution, backed by the current government but rejected by voters in 2022, referred to water 71 times, affirming everyone's right to it, especially if they were poor or indigenous. Yet the draft gave little clue as to how that water might be delivered. The trickiness of water politics is on display at a meeting of small farmers in Punitaqui, a town in northern Chile. Everyone agrees water is too scarce. Some farmers complain big companies have taken an unfair share. Others complain of widespread criminality, including a water inspector getting death threats. An expert shows how to use ultrasound to detect leaks, which are common. Yet many farmers in the room admit they don't even know where their local pipes are buried. In one sense, Chile has plenty of water. To the west is the Pacific Ocean. But getting a permit to build a desalination plant can take more than a decade. The problems are political more than technical. Just for permission to use a bit of shoreline for a plant, a firm must apply to the Ministry of Defence, taking 3 or 4 years. The Archaeological Monuments Council needs to be assured nothing of cultural interest is being damaged. That can take another 3 or 4 years. And then transporting water is a bureaucratic morass. Chile needs to think about water logically, says Ulrika Broschek of Fundación Chile, a think tank. Desalination is useful, but unless powered by renewable energy, it is bad for the climate. By one estimate, global emissions from desalination could match all of those from Britain by 2025. In Chile, bigger, cheaper gains are there to be made. Farms, which account for 4/5 of water use, could use more drip irrigation and hydroponics. If farmers paid directly for water, they would use it more efficiently. Cities, instead of having impermeable pavement everywhere, could use rain gardens to capture rain and replenish the groundwater below. And the rules need to be simpler. 56 public bodies regulate water with no overall coordinator, points out Ms. Broschek. Ms. Lopez, at least, offers an encouragingly pragmatic view. A pending bill will speed up permits for desalination, she promises, and more water infrastructure will be built. More broadly, she argues that water needs to have an appropriate price. Elsewhere, sensible water pricing is as rare as it is necessary. Even in places where it has been shown to work, it can be politically fraught. Take Australia, another dry country where farmers use more water than everyone else combined. Federal and state governments thrashed out an agreement in 2012 to conserve water in the Murray-Darling Basin, Australia's biggest system of interconnecting rivers. It relied on an existing scheme allowing farmers to buy or sell water entitlements. The goal was to save 3,200 gigalitres by 2024, either by buying back entitlements from farmers or by investing in projects that could save equivalent amounts, such as more efficient irrigation systems. Australia has conserved about 2,130 gigalitres of water, equivalent to over 20% of what was previously consumed. Meanwhile, farm output has risen. It helps greatly that the country is rich. The government has pumped $13 billion, that's $8.8 billion, into water saving. Systems for measuring water use are sophisticated. When Malcolm Holm, a dairy farmer, needs to irrigate his pastures, he orders water online. Sensors measure out the volumes. Locks are raised, and it trickles into his fields. The system sustains his 1,200 cattle. Yet nearly everyone is unhappy. Environmentalists say the targets should be more ambitious. Farmers say they are too strict. No one is forced to sell their water to the government, but because many do, the system reduces the total amount available to trade for irrigation. This is one reason why water prices have risen in the past decade. That is the point. Higher prices spur conservation. But they also threaten rural livelihoods. Protests have erupted in rural New South Wales. Preschools are struggling to get children in. Footy clubs haven't got enough players, says Linda Fawns, a councillor in Deniliquin, a small town. A local agricultural mechanic, Jamie Tasker, claims the government is scaremongering about the environment and squeezing irrigation to shore up city votes. Almost 9 out of 10 Australians live in cities, and politicians certainly do not want their taps to run dry, but priorities change as parties alternate in power. The Conservative Liberal Party, which is more pro-farmer and reluctant to do much about climate change, stopped doing water buybacks. The Labour Party, in federal power since 2022, resumed them. And then there is water theft. Last year, a farmer was fined a mere $150,000 for stealing over $1.1 million worth of groundwater. Theft is a business model because fines don't fit the crime, grumbles Robert McBride, an outback sheep farmer. In 2026, the Murray-Darling Plan comes up for review. As droughts grow worse, the government ought to buy back more water, thus raising water prices and driving the least water-efficient farms out of business. They won't go quietly. If the politics of water is touchy in well-off, stable places like Australia and Chile, it is explosive in poorer countries. In many of them, climate change seems to be making the weather more erratic, for example by magnifying the variability inherent in the El Niño Southern Oscillation, a global driver of monsoons and their rains. In April and May, floods in Kenya were the worst in memory, with bridges, schools and railways destroyed. Perhaps 300 people died. Following years of drought, the government was caught off guard, says Kennedy Odeda of Shofco, an NGO serving Kenya's slums. When it started raining, people were happy. Nobody was expecting there to be too much. The government should have been better informed. Persistent drought paves the way for flooding because the soil hardens and the water has nowhere to go but sideways. Kenya's populist president, William Ruto, ignored warnings last year of impending floods. Benina Nzau, a vegetable hawker in Mathare, a Nairobi slum, recalls rain pounding on her tin roof at 5 p.m. on April 23rd. When she peered out, she saw tables and chairs swept along by the nearby river. By 1 a.m, the water was surging through her home. She grabbed her 5 children and took them to higher ground, unable to salvage any possessions. It was life or death. Neighbours were carried off in the deluge. Political dysfunction makes cities less resilient. Rules barring the construction of homes dangerously close to watercourses are ignored, as Nzau's house was only 6 metres away. Landowners bribe officials in order to flout planning codes. Builders pave over wetlands. Whereas scarcity has an obvious solution, higher prices, the problem of too much water does not. Flood defences must be built and people discouraged from living in the riskiest places. But where and how? Kenya's government is sponsoring tree planting along Nairobi's riverbanks to help hold back future floods. A moratorium has been placed on new building permits in the city. Officials are evicting people from homes built 30 metres or less from the riverbanks and destroying the buildings. In the worst affected part of Mathare, all that remains is rubble and a stench of sewage. Compensation for each household was 10,000 shillings. That's $77.60. Many residents are resisting by refusing to leave their shacks. Others want more compensation. Many distrust the government, widely seen as corrupt. Some Kenyans even think politicians deliberately caused the flooding to pave the way for the slum clearances that followed. Belief in such far-fetched conspiracy theories makes cooperation between state and citizens less likely. Squabbles over water can turn violent. The Water Peace and Security Partnership, a global body, crunches data to predict water-related conflicts. Its latest update in June noted that herders and farmers across the Sahel are fighting over scarce water. Drought-related skirmishes are expected in South Africa, Madagascar, and Mozambique, and floods in Iran and Afghanistan have displaced populations into areas where they may not be welcome. Tensions between states are common too. As rivers grow more erratic, negotiations between downstream countries and upstream ones may grow more fraught. Dry countries, such as China and the Gulf states, are buying up farmland in Africa and the Americas to secure future supplies of food. In effect, they are importing vast quantities of water in the form of wheat and soybeans. This could become a political flashpoint. Water wars between states are fortunately rare, but Egypt is furious about an Ethiopian dam that could disrupt its access to the Nile River, from which it gets 9/10 of its water. Talks over how to share the water keep failing. Egyptian officials hint they might go to war. They may be bluffing, but no one can be sure. To avoid water wars, countries need to use water more efficiently. Egypt wastes it copiously, and negotiate more amicably. Much work needs to be done in both areas. The world spends roughly 0.5% of GDP on water, the World Bank estimates, but 28% of allocated public funds go unspent. Meanwhile, a typical water utility has efficiency losses, leaks and theft, of around 16%. As for amicable haggling, 3/5 of the world's 310 international river basins lack frameworks to govern disputes. Another thing that makes water policy hard is that many people, such as those whose homes are too costly to defend from floods or whose crops wither, will eventually have to move. Chilean vineyards are already shifting south. Outback towns will shrink. Inundated Africans and Asians will keep migrating to cities or abroad. Rich countries may be able to help compensate those whose homes and fields are rendered worthless, but the process will be disruptive everywhere. Nonetheless, it should be manageable. The WRI estimates that solving the world's water crises would cost 1% of GDP per year until 2030, and that every $1 invested in sensible ways to do so would yield $6.80 in benefits. However, getting the politics right will require calm, collaborative leadership, disproving the epigram attributed perhaps erroneously to Mark Twain, "Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting."